Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Oh, it hasn't. Did you start?
No, I think it has. Sorry, I have a new phone.
Okay. Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you will find links to prior podcasts from this meeting available in multiple formats. The opinions expressed on the Light a Candle podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Nancy P.
Hi, everyone. I have some lozenges because I'm getting over a cold, but just want to let you know. So my name's Nancy P. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Nancy. And
it's good to see everybody. Some people I know, some people I don't know. And I'm really hoping that tonight I can carry the message. I really like to bring some hope, to people that might be struggling, people that might need a little bit of hope. So I'm going to start out with, I've been in OA for 38 years. I say I've been abstinent about 25 or so years because I actually stopped counting my time. I had a significant amount of abstinence, a number of years when I started, and then I broke my abstinence, and I was so ashamed. I just felt like I couldn't talk about it in an OA meeting. I felt that that what was so important at that time was being abstinent, and that abstinence was the most important thing in my life. Without exception, except it became something I wanted to look good about and feel good about, that I was abstinent. And so when I broke it, I said I had been abstinent for a while, and it did just start out very small. I felt like I was spiritually fit and that I could eat anything that I wanted to. So I started eating sugar again, just a little bit at a time. I worked in UCLA, and they had this great cookie place, Dee Dee Reese. So I'd go there and get one cookie and on my break, and it was fine, cookie and some milk. And then it graduated to a cookie with a brownie. And then I was off and running. And I had one friend in program at that time that I remember I would go to the gym in the parking lot and sit on my phone and talk to her that I was using sugar. I was using food. I couldn't talk about it anywhere else. I just couldn't. It's the craziest thing. So that's why I say at this point, I have something over 25 years of abstinence because I don't count my days. And I know that I'm in recovery. Okay. So I lost probably about 40 pounds. I think those are the kind of the number types of things. So I grew up in a dysfunctional family, like a lot of us will say, but it took me a lot of time to understand how dysfunctional it was, because being in the dysfunction, I didn't have any perspective, and I didn't know that it was that dysfunctional, and it was only really through therapy many years later that the reflections of the therapist helped me to understand that. And so this is kind of what it looked like. My dad had no boundaries, and it was kind of told to me that they would use the word like emotional incest. He had no boundaries. He used to write poetry. He would like read his poetry to me. It was like I was kind of a substitute mom and, wife in some way. My mom, and he was also, he suffered from anorexia and compulsive overeating. He was bipolar, but he denied that. My mom had no self-esteem. Her mother said to her, directly to her, there's something radically wrong with you. And so my mom, that's how my mom grew up. And so how were they to love me and help me to become the person that is meant for me to be? And so I started using food. And I remember using food at a very young age, at about 8 years old. I was a helper. I was in third grade, and the helpers got to go and help the first graders. bring their lunch trays to the, you know, to the trash. So I would do that, but I would take the brownies. I remember it was brownies and grilled cheese day. And I would get the brownies and put them in my pockets and just have them, you know, the rest of the day. I stole money from my mom's purse so I could buy extra cookies from the cookie man who came out right after the cafeteria. I stole her money and would ride my bike down to the liquor store and, I remember buying these. They were Three Musketeer bars, but they weren't the little Halloween ones. They were the big ones. They came in a six-pack. So I would buy those and ride my bike back home, eat some of them, eat a lot of them, and then, you know, not be able to eat anymore and throw them out, and then wait until I felt hungry again, and then go and got the others and ate them. My parents were very concerned about my weight, and when I was probably about 10 or so, we used to go out to dinner at this deli once a week, and whatever I got. I don't remember exactly, but I remember that it was Wednesdays, and Wednesdays were weighing days. And that meant that I was going to go home, and my mom was going to weigh me. And that was so painful. I didn't know, you know, I would leave the restaurant. I would say to her, my brother, my dad was out on Wednesdays, I'll meet you at home. And I would jog home. It wasn't super far, maybe half a mile, or maybe between half a mile and a mile. And I'd be running, and I remember, like, you know, my feet hitting, you know, the concrete, thinking, praying, God, don't let me gain another pound. Or don't let me gain another pound. And it's like, what is, like, a kid thinking about like that? Like, what would have happened if I'd gained a pound? I don't remember, but, I mean, it was that sense of such conditional love. It was just frightening. And there were other things that, you know, my parents also did to help me with my weight, which was my mom would pay me for, you know, pounds that I would lose or something like that. So it was a very difficult time growing up like that. So I moved from sort of the elementary school times to like junior high school. And again, I would take money from my mom's purse at the nutrition, go and buy a cinnamon roll after I'd, of course, already had my breakfast. And, just progressed. In junior high school, I had two binge buddies. And I didn't know that's what we were at the time. I just liked the idea. We would get together and buy the powdered sugar donuts and Doritos. Mm-hmm. And we would just put them in the middle of us, and we would just go and eat. That's what we did. So that was kind of, you know, junior high school-ish. High school continued, of course. Basically, my eating issues, disordered food, went from about, like, 8 years old until, like, college. And I'll hopefully be able to talk about some of that, too. So in high school, I played on a lot of sports teams, and we'd always go to some of the team members would go to the football games, you know, on Friday night. So what did we do after that? At 10 o'clock at night or whatever, when the game was over, we all went to Pizza Hut and just ate more and more. So moving just kind of from high school to college, I guess was when it just really started coming to a head, you know. I worked a couple of summers when I was in college in the national parks, one in Yellowstone and one in Denali. And I was part of the, like, housekeeping. I wasn't like a ranger or anything like that. But, I remember when I was working in Alaska, well, even when I was working in Yellowstone too, just the food was super important. But when I got to Alaska, I was 21, I think, and there was something about the isolation that was very difficult. And I remember at that point making a conscious decision, I am going to use food, because I knew that it was going to help me. And at that point, it did help me. And that reminds me of, I do believe that growing up in the family that I grew up in, God gave me the food. God gave me the food as a tool to deal with being in that family. And of course, I mean, you know, when I moved out of that family, living in that family, I didn't need that protection in the same way. But I still, that was my habit. That was how I knew how to deal with life, how to do that. So I had made that decision when I was in Alaska. And when I came back, I was then going to be in my senior year in college. And, you know, I did all the same things with stealing, you know, roommates' food, trying to cover it up, buying things that needed to be replaced, you know, all that kind of stuff. But what happened was, I guess, it just really started getting much worse. And the self-hatred, the despair, the hopelessness, the frustration, you know, especially the self-hatred. I could not stop eating. And, you know, I wanted to. When I was in college, I went to the diet center, and they had a diet center. I went to school in Santa Barbara. They had a diet center in Goleta, which is where I went first. And then when I completed that and I then gained my weight back, I wanted to go again. So I went to a diet center in other cities, like, so they wouldn't know me, you know. So in that time, I used food to get through school. I used it so I could force myself to study. I was a good student. And, you know, that in some ways, you know, was the problem, that I never got really, in some ways, validated for me. Everything was about how it looked. It was a lot of that. Like, my mom was really especially into, like, how things looked. And so in college, towards the end of college, in my senior year, I remember one morning, I remember the room that I was in, I remember the bed that I was in, I remember waking up and feeling like, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this. I don't want to live anymore. It was just too hard. And at the time, I was 21. Now I'm 59. So I've been in program like a long, most of my growing up years, really. So I didn't really want to live. I was just going through the motions. And someone, a friend, just casually mentioned Overeaters Anonymous. So I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll go. So I went, and that was my entry into OA. It was up in Santa Barbara. And the meetings were really small, but they had one big meeting, and that was like 15 or 20 people on a Friday night in Santa Barbara. So I went by myself to the first meeting, and I remember one guy came up to me, and the thing that's so interesting is this guy, this was like 38 years ago, I saw him on a Zoom meeting, and he's living in San Francisco now. But he came up to me and he said, this is gonna sound like a cult, but it's not. And I'm super glad that he said that to me, because the whole God thing, it would have been too much for me to hear all of that, you know, in the first meeting. So that I was thankful for that. And the other thing that I really got from that meeting, that I really remember and that I think is so important in OA, is hope. Because I didn't stop eating right away, but I saw that people could do it, they were doing it, and it gave me hope. And so, you know, at that first meeting, you know, the speaker was talking about eating loaves of bread. I couldn't believe, like, people were talking about it. They're saying it, you know. And then at the end, oh my God, you know, we all held hands and said this, whatever prayer it was. And I left there feeling good. I felt really good because I felt like I had found something. I'd found, like, the solution. And that started my journey with OA. I can hear the music in the background. It's a steady beat. Maybe I'm supposed to be on some perfect measure. So what was I talking about? Something with coming to the first meeting. Yeah. So at the first meeting, you know, they always say, you hear in OA, get a sponsor. So I really wanted to get a sponsor, but I didn't really know what to do about it or how to do it. And so one of the first sponsors I had 6 months of abstinence, and it was unbelievable to me that she could have 6 months. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So I got this sponsor, and we started working together. And then her brother was killed in a car accident, and she lost her abstinence. So I had lived in Santa Barbara for about a year, and I was going to hopefully be in graduate school in Northern California. But it didn't work out because I only applied to Ivy League schools, the top-rated schools in my field, and I didn't get in. And it was part of this whole like diseased way of being. Like, I didn't really want to see the reality of anything. I just wanted it to be my way. So I didn't get in, but I decided to stay up there. And one thing that was really nice about OA was that I was very immersed in it for that year, my first year in Santa Barbara. I went to a meeting almost every day for the first year and a half that I was in program. And I did that because I couldn't stop eating. I needed to go every day to connect with people that knew what I was talking about. So I packed up my OA program. I moved up north. And I was living in the Oakland Hills. And I knew I just wanted to plug into the program there. So I did. And it was good. And again, I wanted to find a sponsor. And I asked a woman that I loved the way she shared, and she was full, right? She didn't have any space. So I went around for a little bit of time, and then some space happened for her. So I was happy, thankful. I could work with this person. So this person said to me something that I've heard frequently, not as much anymore, but if you want what I have, then you'll do what I do. And I took that seriously. So her plan of eating was no sugar and no flour. And so for me, I had already been trying to do no sugar. And even that sometimes can be confusing. When I hear people say no sugar, at least when I heard this in the beginning, I thought that meant no sugar. And so when I saw sugar in ketchup or sugar in barbecue sauce or something like that, I thought, how can they be saying they're abstinent if they're eating that because it has sugar in it? You know, because sugar is even in bread. I mean, it's in a lot of things. But just to simplify it for myself, no sugar means for me no recreational sugar, like no cookies, no cakes, no brownies, none of that. And I did dabble in sugar-free food for a long time in program, which I don't do now. And God, I feel like I have so many different things and tangents that I can go off on. It's hard for me to just think about telling my story in some way. Because when I start talking about abstinence and sugar and, you know, that, I think, you know, abstinence is hard. It's not easy putting down the food. And I didn't want to put down the food. You know, it says the only requirement is a desire to stop eating compulsively. I may have said that when I came in, but I didn't really want to do that because the food still worked. And, you know, it worked. And then when it stopped working, it was when the pain of eating compulsively was really greater than the pain I was trying to avoid, the self-hatred, all of that. So back to this person in Berkeley who said that to me. That's what I did because I was desperate and I wanted to follow direction. Now, it's different. You know, I've been in the program a long time and I have a very good intuitive sense of what is right for me. And I do have a sponsor. I don't talk to her all the time. I've been working with her for maybe 5 years or so. And here's another digression. When I first came into the program, so I was up in Berkeley. I started following the program the way she said to do it, with that abstinence. And you know, that abstinence didn't work for me. It didn't work for me. And I wound up getting sick, not from that particular food plan, but I wound up getting sick and I had to move home after living in Berkeley by myself for about a year. And I moved home and I started going to programs, to meetings, you know, my parents lived in the San Fernando Valley, so I went to some meetings over at the old Darby place for a while. And then I moved into West LA area. I started going to Santa Monica meetings. So I met my first long-term sponsor that I had for about 10 years. And she was so special to me. She was like one of the first people that I think really loved me, or that I felt it. You know, and that's another thing with the food. When I'm in the food, I can't feel it. I can't feel it even if it's coming my way. You know, so that's tough. But this sponsor, we just connected, and I have to say, getting the right sponsor is important. And sponsorship, it can be such a complicated tool. I mean, you know, I've sponsored a lot of different people. Some people stay for a while and they go. Some people come, they leave. I mean, it's a big different kinds of things in sponsorship. And I think, you know, a little bit for me with that first sponsor, I was in my early 20s and she was probably in her early 50s or so. It was kind of like a mom thing. But, you know, I've grown in the fellowship. I don't need my sponsor to be my mom. I need my sponsor to help me see things sometimes. She can point things out and I can see them, or she can help me if I'm going through something. So this first sponsor, I'm going to jump a little bit. We parted after about 10 years, and it wasn't on great terms, but she always resided with me. There was something about her that was just touched me. And so eventually I wound up reconnecting with her, and it was fun. We always could laugh together. That was really nice, to be able to laugh and kind of make fun of ourselves sometimes. We'd get into these deep, 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 serious conversations about God and this, and then we'd always come back and start laughing. So we reconnected, and she had moved up to Eugene, Oregon. And so we connected and we were talking regularly, and then she wound up getting brain cancer. And, you know, the last time I had talked to her on the phone, she said, "You know, Nance, I don't really know how much time I have." And this relationship was so special and so deep for me that I knew I wanted to see her. So I went to Eugene by myself, which was a big deal. And her partner picked me up at the airport, and we came back to her place, and she was now, you know, on hospice care and towards the end of her life. And they had her bed right in the middle of the living room, so she could see the outside, and people come in, they would see her. And, you know, it was just this incredible experience of being in this river of love. It wasn't about talking. It was about everybody tending to this woman's spirit that was going to be transitioning, you know, to dying. And from that experience, wow, I learned so much about love. And I mean, ultimately, I think that's what this program is about. That's what it's about for me at this point. So she died about 2 weeks after I was there. So she was very close to death. And so that was a really special relationship. And that was right before COVID. So it wasn't that long ago. So that was my first sponsor. The second sponsor, second long-term sponsor I had for 13 years. And, you know, I would call her a lot. And after 13 years, she dropped me. And I wanted to know why. She wouldn't tell me. She couldn't tell me. She would just say, well, it's not working for me, or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it was. And it was difficult. It put me in a situation where I didn't have a sponsor. And at that point, I felt like I really needed a sponsor. This is like my connection to the program. And I kind of flailed around a little bit until I found the sponsor that I have now. And as I said, I work with, you know, we it's interesting. She's so different than me. But I'm not looking for the same things that I did when I first came in. So I can't even remember where I'm leaving off here with sponsorship. So let's see, how much time do I have here? I guess I'll try and talk about what it's like today. And I'm not sure how long I'm gonna be able to talk for or not on this. But what it's like today is way, way different than it was when I came in. Completely different. They talk about a spiritual awakening. They talk about immediate experiences. They talk about educational types of experiences. And I've had like everything. So, you know, what it's like today is that I'm free. I'm free. I don't have a compulsion to eat food, to eat more food. Don't have a lot of obsession about the food. But I really do pay a lot of attention to it. I have disciplines that help me stay with the freedom that I have. So, you know, for instance, I was thinking about this when I was like coming over here. What am I going to share about? What's important? You know, that kind of stuff. So I kind of wanted to share some specifics about what I do, which is maybe helpful, I hope. Usually the night before, I make a schedule. I have a schedule for myself. How much am I working? What meetings am I going to? Who am I seeing? What errands do I have to do? I mean, I have a schedule. And when I know that, you know, a lot of things center around my meals. I like to have a good meal. I like to sit down and enjoy my food. I don't like eating on the run. Like, to me, you know, a meal is a great time. So if I'm looking at my schedule and I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I got this meeting at 12:30, well, I usually eat at 1. How am I going to do my food? I got to plan. You know, they have that saying, fail to plan, plan to fail. I do a lot of planning, and it's really helpful. Like, I look at when my meal's going to be. And, you know, for what do I eat? Well, when I first came in, I mentioned I came in actually when I was in my last year of college. I didn't know what to eat. I just knew that my eating was crazy. So it was kind of like this like thing came to me. Well, for lunch, a sandwich and a piece of fruit, that seems normal, whatever, you know? So that's kind of how I started. And I've gone through different things with my food in the program. I've worked where I've, 10 minutes, thank you. I've called my food in, mostly in the evening, to be honest about what I've eaten, because doing it beforehand, it felt difficult. Like, I didn't feel like I could stick to it for some reason or something, but I wanted to be honest. That was kind of in the beginning. So what I do now is some foods I measure. I don't really weigh too many things. I don't have like chicken or things that I'm weighing, but I do measure. Like in the morning, I usually have grape nuts. I measure like half a cup of grape nuts. I have about a quarter of a cup of an apple, and I have like a little bit of coffee in my decaf, a little bit of milk in my decaf coffee. For lunch, I usually have some variation of a Trader Joe's salad that I buy. I add lettuce to it. I measure half a cup of peanuts, and I do that every day. I have a different salad, but I always have half a cup of peanuts because I love peanuts. But I'm not binging on them, though. You know, that's the point. And then and one rice cake. Then in the afternoon, I usually am hungry. In the afternoon, like 4 or 5, I usually have a power bar. And then for dinner, we have dinner together, my husband, myself, and my daughter, many nights of the week that are we know what we're having. So my food's not a big surprise most of the time. If I'm going out somewhere, I do look at the menu ahead of time, try and get an idea of what I can eat or what I want to eat. And that's another thing. When I first came in, and throughout the time, I never really identified as being a restrictor. But I realized more recently, yeah, I kind of am a restrictor, or I was a restrictor, because, you know, I wouldn't eat sugar, but then I tried to cut out everything, you know, that was going to be, that would cause weight gain. You know, I didn't really, I want to be thin, and I am happy with the body that I have today. And I work at it. I watch my food, but I'm not restricting. We go out for pizza once a week. Usually tonight we're going to go out for pizza. Sundays we go out usually for Mexican food. But I can eat and stop before my plate is full, before my plate is empty. I can do that. So, you know, all of that has come from a tremendous amount of work and commitment to the spiritual part of this program. I was just working with a sponsee the other day, and it, you know, it says in the big book that we straighten out spiritually first and then physically and mentally. And I work super hard at that. And I haven't said much about the steps really, but I've worked the steps in many different ways. And the last time I went through the steps, I did it, you know, the big book way with the columns, and I really learned some things about myself. So the steps are really important. And one thing I always try to remember and that I want to share about the steps and my recovery is that alongside my 12-step program, I have outside help. Now, I know that I was eating because of the pain of growing up in that family. And that was protective for me. So when I start working the steps and I'm looking at myself, I'm looking at things, you know, the steps are not therapy. And I needed something to go help me go deeper to heal those things. I can't heal those things if I'm still eating. So I need to put the food down so that I can recover with the steps and then have my outside help me, you know, process things. So it also reminds me that, you know, you hear this so many times, you know, the program is simple but not easy, something like that. And part of what that means to me is that I really try to refrain from judging people for being in the food. We're in OA. We hope that we're not going to be in the food. We don't want to be in the food. But we do use the food for reasons. And I know some of the pain that was under that food because I'm not doing that food anymore. And so there's some kind of acknowledgement and compassion for people that are still in the food, because it is hard to put that food down unless you are really suffering. And I suffered. I really suffered. And that, you know, they talk about that gift of desperation. And I had that, and I'm grateful that I had it. I don't feel desperate today in the same way. What I'm desperate for today is a connection with my higher power. That's everything. And that even harkens back to what I was saying before about abstinence is the most important thing in my life without exception. Well, I don't say that. Partly because I don't believe that, you know, I took that to the extreme, to the compulsive overeating extreme. You know, if I wasn't abstinent, I didn't want to live. I wanted to die. I wanted to kill myself because I wasn't abstinent and it didn't look good. So I just really try to remember how hard it is to give up the food. And, you know, we're here to help each other. I do a lot of work, as I was mentioning before, in a solitary manner. I get up in the morning. My shower is a big thing in the morning for me. It wakes me up. I like it. I have like a routine that I go through with my books. I usually read 2 pages of the big book on an ongoing basis. I redrafted the On Awakening. So if you read On Awakening, there's some things in there that it says we're going to do, and there's some things in there that it says God is going to do. So I rewrote that script. So when I do it, you know, I read through it in the morning, I do that. I meditate, and that is really important for me. Meditation is a key for me, because when I meditate, I sit and I'm not focusing on my breath. I'm not focusing on a guided meditation. I'm just sitting and I'm letting my mind just unwind and go. And I can see it. I can see the thoughts as they're happening. And so, you know, I'm done with my meditation and now I'm off into my day. I'm doing whatever I'm doing. And now I can, I'm not impulsive in what I do. I'm not, you know, boom, boom, boom. It's more of being able to kind of see my thoughts and not being have to act on them. So I do a lot of things that are solitary. But I remember I went through a period one time, I was telling my sponsor, I don't really like going to meetings, they seem kind of clicky. Some of the meetings seem kind of clicky, maybe some of them are. She said, well, you know, the program is not the meetings. You know, the program is, you know, it's in the book, and it talks in the book about the purpose is to help us find a way to deal with our lack of power, to find a higher power. So my even that aspect of my life has changed tremendously. I am in love with this fellowship. I love it. I love the people in it. I love, you know, the people that I've known for years and years and years. And the people that are just new, the people that may be struggling, the people that need help. And I try to be that kind of a person that can extend a hand, extend a phone call, help a newcomer feel welcome, and carry the message, as I started out tonight, about hope. You know, the whole big, you know, saying, keep coming back, you know, we'll love you until you can love yourself. There's so many of these little cliches, you know, but today I can really say the most satisfying and purposeful thing in my life that I do is helping other people recover. And not that I'm better than, it's that I have the experience now. You know, I've been here for a long time. I've seen a lot of different things. And, you know, that's what I try to remember. When I get really busy and I've got things going on in the day, somebody calls, I consciously say to myself, you know, this is important. A phone call is important. An OA phone call is important. And I had someone call me the other day, which was super nice. She called me and she had said to me previously, I really like it. You're one of those people that will answer your phone. Mm. You know, I'll pick up the phone and try to talk to somebody. Is that it? Oh, perfect. Thank you.
It is now time for our set of conditions. Well, we have no